It's Wednesday, August 23rd, 2023, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, the Marion County Record has all of its items returned. We'll talk about the revocation of that search warrant that was executed and what has gone on since then. Meta is making moves. A Threads desktop interface could be ready and accessible to people within days. And why news outlets say they're seeing a steep decline in referrals to their websites. And nearly 20 years later, the NFL player many came to know through the movie The Blind Side says he was never adopted by the Tuohy family, and he wants the money that the family made off his name, image, and likeness from the time that he was 18 years old. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to today before our half hour is up, but we're going to start with more changes at X, formerly known as Twitter, as the platform's functionality is dismantled piece by piece. And some of these latest changes, well, they hit us journalists where it really hurts. Monday, Elon Musk tweeted that X will change how links to news articles appear on the platform, removing the headlines and text which accompany images and links in tweets. Instead, only an image and a link will appear, supposedly to limit the height of posts and improve, with air quotes, the aesthetic, while removing any of the context that might have been present, Ernest?
Well, I mean, again, this is one of those where the journalists themselves, mm-hmm. who are being impacted, and others, are saying this is another attempt by Elon Musk to basically control what content goes out, and he's using it to sort of decide what is news and what is not news as he sees it. And again, he's going after the journalists, as he has always done, to say, you know, wait a minute, I don't trust you guys, and I'm not going to just give you carte blanche to do what you will on my platform.
Yeah, well, I think this is the platform, let's face it, that has been most important to journalists. It's been an important way to, journalists use Twitter almost like we used to use the AP Newswire. We keep up with what each other are doing. We follow each other. We have ways that I think you're going to talk about.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, so that. What you're saying, too, is we have used Twitter, mm-hmm. Almost as a wire service to publish, right, as the Associated Press does, and getting dispatches out and iterative reporting. But one of the other functions that went away, I woke up to this Friday morning and frankly raced into the office to redo some of the courses that I teach that started just this past Monday, doing away with a functionality called TweetDeck.
Yeah.
And TweetDeck was, okay, I'm going to say it, it was great. I had been using this probably since about 2008, and TweetDeck allowed users to both manage multiple accounts, but to do forward searches as well, using hashtags, using geolocation, so you could put in an exact location and maybe how many kilometers out from there, using latitude and longitude.
So just to explain to listeners and viewers, sure, why that's important, if a big news event happened,
absolutely,
we just found out that there was a crash or an explosion in Boonville, say, we would, before we could get people out there, we would start to geolocate tweets from that area so we could get real-time citizen reporting. So that's why it was a very useful tool.
Absolutely. And you could also search not only by geolocation, but what that tweet contained, if it was just text, or you could search for photos or video as well. So if you bring up the idea of a train derailment, and that's a great example, given that there was a pretty serious train derailment in this region, about a year ago.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what you could do as a breaking news reporter is look for that part of the train track in Sheridan County, and you could look to see what people were posting on Twitter. You could do that looking for photos, and you could get to people who were on the train, who were there and sharing that information before any of the news organizations here in the Columbia or Jefferson City area could get people on the ground and begin the reporting.
But let's be clear here also.
Yes.
it still exists. You just have to...
Okay, fair. You have to pay $8 a month to get that access.
And get the premium X or whatever he's calling it now.
And to quote one of my friends who is a journalist at a major... an editor at a major metropolitan newspaper, there's no way I'm giving Elon Musk a dime for access to that.
Right, right. But, you know, he's basically saying, that's fine. Don't do it. You don't get access to this. And... all of the functionality that you just described, I think eventually what's going to happen is that someone, either the reporter themselves or the companies they work for, are going to pay that $8 so they can have that functionality because they've become dependent upon it. And that's one of the things that I think we are starting to see is that, you know, Twitter and other social media apps they're almost like the telephone when
the utility.
Bell, it's
so I was
almost like
say,
a utility. Yeah,
that is the interesting, and that is the interesting thing I think we're going to see unfold. Of course, it's kind of classic. It's kind of the leading give you free services that you're then going to become reliant on and then say, oops, now it's going to cost you something. So that's kind of a classic marketing tool. But I do think you're absolutely right, Ernest, because what has happened and what we're really talking about here is that digital services have supplanted what legacy media once were to communities. Legacy media, either through the courts or through the federal government, have always been regulated in some way or another. And now what we're seeing a big debate over is, should we regulate some of these services that have been or living in the wild, wild west right now? And what are the implications of that for free speech? What are the implications of that for customer service? But I think that's where this debate is going.
And you're already seeing it in Europe. I mean, they're already being regulated to a certain extent in Europe. And eventually, I think here, we're going to have to decide, are the digital and social media apps, have they become such a integral part of our ecosystem that they fall under the utilities rules
exactly.
that we've all grown up with? In other words, will the federal government or state governments or local governments step in and say, wait a minute, these are essential parts of the life of our communities, therefore we need to have some sort of regulation.
And in some ways, you're seeing a step towards that right here in Missouri, where we have now received $1.7 billion in federal funding to expand broadband, and our Missouri Extension Service is very involved in this, because the federal government is saying, and I think a lot of people feel, that everybody needs access to high-speed internet in order to be functional in a digital world.
And that was going to be my question, too, is does regulating the internet come before regulating the social media and digital companies such as Meta, X, or Google? Like, which one do you go after first in that way?
I don't know, but we're probably at the point where we're going to have to start thinking about regulating them both at the same time, because if you're creating this access, but you don't control the content that is necessary for people to actually be able to function once they gain access, then where are we? I mean, and that's the problem. So, okay, good, I've got the access, but now I have to pay these exorbitant fees in order to be able to access that. And that's not regulated. And so therein becomes a problem.
Exactly. And that is where it comes, just like your public utility commission that regulates how much you pay for gas or water or electricity. And that, I think we may well be headed in that direction.
Okay, so in other social spaces, use of Meta's Twitter killer dropped off dramatically in the days immediately following Threads' release in early July. And one of the reasons a lot of people, myself among them, has said that they have really not spent a whole lot of time on there is that it's mobile only, that the lack of a desktop interface or a desktop app, either web browser or as an app, really cuts down on the functionality, because the only way to use that is on a mobile device, on an iPad or a tablet or on a smartphone. Well, they're saying that they've got a desktop function and it could be rolled out as early as next week.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens. I mean, I think, you know, the appeal of Twitter was Twitter came first. It had an awful lot of users. That's where everybody went. Since Musk took over Twitter and has been doing his best to kill it, in my opinion, you've got a lot of alternatives out there. You've got Mastodon, you've got Threads, and some others. And the question is, where
Spill,
is every
Post yeah. News?
Thank you.
I think I've listed
You're
seven
much more
different.
Hip
well,
than I am.
No, not hip, but have listed about seven or eight of them that I'm asking students to at least try and check yeah. out and experiment with a yeah. little bit.
But that is, you know, and it's the same kind of thing we've seen on TV. You yeah. know, we used to have three networks and everybody knew what was going on. It's the same thing. It's a balkanization of the users and the audience. And so, unless and until, and again, getting back to the utility thing, one of the things that makes there. There are certain things where a monopoly is useful.
That's right.
And because we don't want to have to pick, you know, we don't want to have like six different companies digging in our yard. And so it's the same here. I mean, do we want a place that everybody goes? I don't know. I mean, we're really in early days, but
yeah,
I'm
keep
skeptical.
Saying early days, and it's
and it's every week. Yeah. You can go back and look yeah. at the entire
right.
archive.
But yeah. I'm skeptical that we're at a point where there's going to be a settled on alternative where, you know, at least the news media goes to share and to use to market itself mm-hmm. and to also find out what other reporters are doing.
Right. One of the things you were talking about Europe, Ernest, one of the things going on up in Canada is that Meta has severely restricted, almost shut out all inclusion of news content in its feeds. Here in the United States, news organizations are noticing that there has been a tweak to the algorithm that has cut down traffic to news websites dramatically, that those referrals aren't coming in the way that they once were. It's one more example of how that free product, we became the product by using a product that was free and are now reaping additional.
Right.
We're being punished.
We're being punished. Yeah. Well, yeah. And here's the thing. I mean, this started, again, it started in Europe mm-hmm. where European regulators basically said, look, you know, if Facebook, Meta, is
or
going
Google. Yeah.
Google, if you're going to put that product on your sites, then you have to pay the people who are actually doing the work. Mm-hmm. And when that happened, Meta said, hey, you know, then we're not going to do it. And that leads to basically what you just described. Now it's happening in Canada. And because, you know, we live in a global society, it is starting to have an impact on media operations worldwide. And it all goes back to Meta, Google, you know, you name it, having to share wealth. And they don't want to share.
Nobody does. One thing about social media, it has gone a long way toward giving people in countries outside of the U.S., a platform to broadcast their free speech within reason. It's been a way of getting information out during the Arab Spring, during protests across Europe and Central Asia. I think about how I learned about protests a few years ago in Kazakhstan specifically because of work I did there, and along with others from our school in support of a grant from the Open Society Foundation, George Soros's outlet for promotion of free speech and human rights. Late last week, there were major layoffs there and a change in direction as Soros's son takes greater control. And Kathy, this has many worried about what could happen in the fight for democracy in former communist countries, former Soviet states across Eastern Europe.
Yeah, well, the Open Society's foundations are a real behemoth of philanthropy. And George Soros, who was the founder, made a lot of money, was born in Hungary. Mm-hmm. And so he made a lot of his money in America, but he became dedicated to Open Societies as the name of his foundation because he felt that was a way to build wealth and democracy. So while he was at the helm, his foundation pumped a lot of money into basically the area where he grew up, Central Europe, Europe and Central Asia. And I checked the figures last night. Last year, it was $209 million that they pumped in, up 13% of their global spending, but 13 or 14%. So this is a lot of money, and they supported things like the Ukraine, democracy in Ukraine, like Moldova, which is supposed to be the next country on Vladimir Putin's hit list. So I think at a time, you know, I think it's easy to say, well, everything's taken care of in Europe. It certainly isn't. We can see it in Ukraine, and we see just today we have a report that the head of the Wagner Group, who led the attempted coup against Vladimir Putin, was in a plane crash that has mysteriously crashed in Russia. We don't know if that's true or not, but I think it's an indication of how unstable democracy is in Central Europe, and so I think that's why you see the concern about the Soros reports that the Soros Foundation is pulling out.
Well, when you have a major foundation that is championing human rights and free speech and to a certain extent freedom of the press, begin to pull back, especially in an area that desperately needs it, that's a cause for concern on the part of a lot of people who are really on the front lines trying to do this, because they really needed that support. And so it's not just, you know, it's not just the fact that they're fighting this human rights, but now you have, I mean, you're talking about 41%. I mean, that of the people who are working just for Soros alone, not to mention all the people who were also working in various organizations that were being supported, that you're talking about a lot of people who are doing a lot of good work who are now being impacted by this decision.
I'd like to throw a little hand grenade into this conversation, too. I know this is going to be controversial, but, you know, what this shows to me is back in the 80s, there was a fad for tax cutting, and we cut taxes, particularly on wealthy people, quite a bit. What that did was it allowed for an enormous accumulation of wealth. Some of the people who accumulated that wealth, to their everlasting credit, have become philanthropists, and they give money to worthy causes. But it is the whim of the giver, right? And I think this is a demonstration of that. Oh, we're having a generational change. Well, whoops, we're going to pull out. And how many of us who have worked with foundations have had this, oh, I'm working on this grant, but then suddenly that's not the priority for next year? The problem is when you allow enormous amount of wealth to accumulate and be in the hands of a few people, what they use that money for is up to them, as opposed to allowing that money to be collected in taxes, where you and I get to vote for the people who decide how that money is spent. So we have a say in how that money is spent. And I think this is the hidden side of that story, that putting all that power in a few hands is not healthy in a democracy.
Okay, that gives us all something to think about and to spend
and
some time
to get mad about. So the philanthropist will be mad at me. That's okay.
Good luck on your next grant proposal.
Thank you. Yeah, I know.
After our show last Wednesday, the folks at the Marion County Record in Kansas got all of their equipment back. The search warrant, which...
Do you think it's our fault? Or should we take credit?
Maybe. I don't know.
It was within minutes.
It was our little show right here in Mid-Missouri. But they got all the equipment back that search warrant was permitting the seizure for. That warrant was revoked. And much to the relief of the paper's owners and journalists across the country who had taken up the cause celeb. Again, the three of us among them. But there was a great piece in the New York Times that you can, of course, find on our links blog that looks at the other discussion that's happening around this. And this is the discussion going on between the 2,000 or so residents of the town and the paper's owner about what the relationship should be between a community and its newspaper. Many there did see this raid as a blatant violation of the First Amendment, but they also saw it as the bubbling up of tensions that had really been growing over time, over what was seen as insensitive coverage of the death of two people in town, a series about a paperwork error that resulted in denial of tax credits, and even an opinion piece that critiqued the quality of letters to Santa. they say they want a paper that bolsters the town's image, that bolsters the town, like tells good stories about the town. And this paper's just been too negative.
Well, I mean, you could say that about a lot of. I mean, I read the story and I was I was just thinking about, you know, my own path through journalism and how often the negative that comes out in a newspaper or on local television is seen as indicative of what the media the news media organization does, and not all of the good stories. The fact that they're there for the parades, they're there for the picnics, they're there for the celebrations, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. And this may be, especially when you talk about a town that's small, this may be a sort of a small example of that. We're going to hold on to all that negative when something big happens and you find yourself in the spotlight for negative reasons, as opposed to if something great had happened in Marion and the newspaper was the one that sort of exposed that, would that narrative be the same?
Well, and I agree with Ernest. I think, you know, it's really interesting. There is nothing, in my opinion, harder to do than local journalism, because your sources are in the supermarket with you, mm-hmm. you know, and you're going to hear about it. So finding that balancing point is a lot harder between, you know, covering the community in a sympathetic way and also calling out the wrongs that need to be called out. That's always a lot harder, and you're going to get a lot more criticism. So you really have to have a thick hide. I think much, much thicker to do local journalism than national journalism, which is why all props to people who do that. But I think the other thing is, I agree with Ernest that people's memory is selective. And even the day that this raid happened, I went on to the Marion Records website, and they had a lovely story about a young boy, maybe 9 or 10 years old, who would go to the local senior center and practice, I forget what musical instrument it was, but practice the musical instrument he played with a 101-year-old man. And it was lovely. So it's not like this paper does nothing but exposés. I mean, they're clearly doing the good stuff as well.
Well, and to be fair, the owner says he has this job to be the watchdog. Like, big town, little town, single Main Street. That is in part his job. And one of the critics in the piece, again, out of fairness, we should point out, is a local judge who is running uncontested for mayor. So he also may have a little bit of a vested interest in not wanting what he was calling, saying he was going just shy of calling mean coverage about him, too.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and this is the tactic we've seen people called nasty for doing their jobs.
So. True. But it does kind of bring up that question of where is that relationship? What is the both and of covering?
But it also points to where we are when it comes to the way in which the public feels about journalism and what journalists do. They've been vilified mm-hmm. for a very long time by both the left and the right, and sometimes by the middle, because they are having to cover all these stories. And when the public is seeing every day that the journalist is the fault, the journalists are doing this, the journalists are doing that, all of a sudden that becomes the narrative, and they're looking at the journalists more so than they're really looking at the people who the journalists are covering the issues that they're covering.
I want us to be careful about wanting to be loved. You know, as journalists, that is not our job. We didn't get into this to win a popularity contest. On the other hand, I will say this about the beefs. We have to acknowledge that there is more than bad news in this world. And if we only provide the bad news, we are not giving an accurate picture of the world we live in. People do get value for their taxes, and not everything's a scam. And I think if we, you know, in some ways, I consider Watergate both the highlight and the lowlight of journalism. A highlight, clearly, it's an acme of watchdog journalism. But I think by making it the acme, we've basically said to a whole generation of reporters that you need to have a scalp in order to, somebody you brought down,
right,
in order to be taken seriously as a reporter. And I think that's wrong. And I think we need to understand as journalists that our job is to report the good as well as the bad.
I want to throw a yes and in there. And thinking about audience, because Is it, I've always kind of asked this hypothetical question, is it journalism if nobody consumes it? And if you don't have an audience, even if it is the best story of all time that could create the greatest change of all time, if you don't have an audience who's wanting to consume it, and if you don't have the philanthropist who may be having the changing priorities, our profession is still ultimately a business. And if we don't have an audience who wants to consume it, we don't have advertisers who want to pump money into our commercial enterprises. If we're public media, we don't have donors or members or supporters. That I think we have to, on some level, still listen to our audiences a little bit more for what they're looking for us to cover and strike that balance. That we do need to be liked a little bit, if not loved.
Well, I mean, I would agree with that, but to me,
valued, maybe.
Yeah, valued, okay. Valued.
That's a good word.
That's a very good word. We do need to have that, but I also think that quite often we get caught in this sort of cycle of the type of news. We go political, at the expense of what people really care about, which is the bread and butter issues we say we should be covering, but we don't really do a good job of. Climate change. Now, I mean, what's happening with the climate and the environment is huge right now, but this has been coming. But now that all these events are happening, we're going like, whoa, this is, now we really have to cover it. So, but we're still, we fall into these traps at the expense of other things that the public really wants to hear about. And they kind of get turned off when mm-hmm. that's all we cover is, say, politics, or all we cover is bad news in the economy. And I think that's part of the whole thing about value. We need to understand in terms of what are we giving them the value that they're looking for when they turn on the TV.
My message to the audience would be, you get what you click on.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So if you want more serious news, support it. And when your local news outlet says, we're having a reader forum, take that seriously and participate in it, because we do listen. As Amy said, I think really eloquently, we understand that. Yes. You know, we're commercial enterprises. In one way or another, we have to earn your, maybe not, we do have to earn your trust, but we have to earn your loyalty. And people will listen, so take it seriously and participate.
I like that message. I'm going to actually throw our control room for a little bit of a loop. We are running out of time very quickly, so we're going to end up tabling our discussion about Michael Oher and the two E's and the adoption or the conservatorship. Okay. And I'm going to throw a question that Kathy asked as we were all sitting down today about who's going to end up watching the debates tonight and what else, what interest there might even be in those.
I'm going to watch.
Okay.
And I'm going to watch largely for the reason that everyone's been complaining about. Donald Trump won't be on. And I think that gives, you know, I'm a political reporter by trade, and I'm really interested to hear what the other candidates have to say. And I think it's a wonderful opportunity for people, for new voices to be heard, and for the candidates to get an opportunity to present themselves. I mean, I was saying this earlier, I'm a boomer. I think it's time to hear from the next generation, somebody who's under 75.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, we are out of time for today. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about and that conservatorship on our Links blog. That's on kbia.org under both the programs and the podcasts tab. You can follow us on Facebook, on X, formerly known as Twitter. Our handle there is @views on KBIA. And we also encourage you to look at subscribing to our podcast. You can do that wherever you get your podcast downloads. These are all great ways to watch and listen to the program again and see what we'll be talking about next week. Thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing the show, to Kia Thomas for handling the audio, Tim Pilcher composed our theme music, and Nate Brown is our social media manager.